A suit!
Vosnesensky's heavy voice roared through the dome.
At once! Into your hard suit! Now!
Cosmonaut Leonid Porbukin was on duty in the command center of Mars 2 when the first pinging noise made him sit up rigidly in his chair. Cold sweat beaded across his upper lip. My God, it must be me, he thought. I'm a Jonah, a Jinx, first Konoye, and now this. But while his mind raced, his hands moved almost as fast. He flicked on the radar display, and almost immediately, with the speed of a reflex action, he hit the alarm.
Meteors! We're running into a swarm of meteors!
He yelled into the ship's intercom microphone, so excited that he said it in Russian. Will Martin, the American geophysicist, happened to be at the comm console in the middle of taping a long report back to Earth.
What is it?
He shouted over the hooting of the alarm.
Speak English, damn it!
Meteors!
Tolbukin shouted back.
Get into your hard suit at once!
Vosnesensky was at the dome's command center, locked in an earnest conversation with Mironov and Abel about the logistics of the upcoming traverse to Pavonis Mons, while ostensibly monitoring the scientists who were outside with Pete Connors. He had not heard the first soft warning sounds of meteoroids striking the dome's exterior shell. Both the dome and the orbiting spacecraft were double-walled, the ships of metal, the dome of plastic. Although Mars's atmosphere was almost vanishingly thin by terrestrial standards, it still offered enough resistance to incoming meteors to burn most of them to ashes long before they reached the ground. The greatest danger, according to the mission planners, came from meteors plunging almost straight in from overhead. They would have the most energy and be most likely to survive the blazing heat of their atmospheric ride and reach the ground sizable enough to do damage. Meteors coming in from lower angles would have to traverse a longer path in the atmosphere, burning every centimeter of the way. Therefore, the dome's double walls were filled in along its top half with spongy, plastic material that could absorb the energy of an impact. Tolbukin's warning blared in the dome's radio speakers, as well as throughout the orbiting ships. Vosnesensky stopped in mid-word and bellowed,
"Everyone, into your suits! At once! Into your hard suits! Now!"
Only after he started running for the suit lockers by the airlock section did the Russian feel the fear that squeezed inside his chest like a cold fist. Connors was the first to notice the tiny puff of dirt spouting out of the ground as if a rifle bullet had struck. The astronaut blinked, watched the dust settle slowly back to the ground, thinking, "Good thing that didn't hit any." Another puff sprouted, 10 meters away.
"Jesus Christ!"
he yelled into his helmet microphone.
"Meteors! Everybody, back to the dome, double quick!"
All six of the geology and biology scientists were spread across several hundred meters of the rock-strewn plain, trying to survey in detail the depth of the permafrost layer beneath the ground. The mapping work was slow, since they were doing it on foot. All excursions in the rovers were on hold until the mission controllers decided exactly where the rovers would be allowed to go. Jamie was holding a digging pole whose toothed bit end drilled into the ground. He jerked to attention at Connor's shouted warning. The pole's bit stopped as soon as his gloved hands released the control stud, and the pole leaned lopsidedly out of the hole in the ground. Jamie took in the locations of the five other scientists with a swift glance. Connor's was to his right, halfway between him and the dome's airlock. Joanna was farther off, struggling with her corer.
"Now, move it, move it!"
Connors was yelling so loud that it hurt Jamie's ears.
"Come on, into the dome!"
Jamie angled off toward Joanna, watching the other hard-suited figure start into clumsy motion like a small herd of brightly colored hippos. A spurt of dust erupted near her, but she did not seem to notice. He ran as fast as he could toward her, feeling like a galumphing tortoise while he fiddled with the radio controls on his wrist to turn down the volume of Connors' urgent voice. He reached Joanna as she finally started to move toward the dome. Slowing to her pace, Jamie knew he could not speak with her because Connors was flooding the suit-to-suit frequency with his hollering. Instead, he reached out to touch her shoulder. He could not see her face through the tinted visor of her helmet, could not see how frightened she was. Then Jamie realized he himself was scared, sweating cold, innards shaking. The ground was erupting into puffs of dust, as if a squad of riflemen had them under fire. Something banged at the back of his helmet. Just a tap, really, but it startled him as if he'd been shot. He looked up and saw that the dome was dimpling here and there as meteoroids struck its surface. Oh, my God! one of them breaks through. One did. Jamie saw the transparent fabric on the lower level of the dome pucker for an instant, and then a small geyser of spray erupted into the dry, thin air, like a whale spouting.
The dome's punctured!
Somebody screamed. The hole spread into a growing rip as moisture-laden air geysered out into the Martian atmosphere, and the plastic fabric of the dome began to sag noticeably. After that first moment of near panic, Voznesensky turned coldly calm. While the others rushed for their suits, he veered aside and trotted around the inner periphery of the dome, checking to see if the repair patches were in their proper places. He had checked the patches only a day earlier, part of his regular inspection routine, but now he checked them again, while a patter of puck-puck sounds rained gently over his head, almost drowned out by the fearful voices of Toshima and the flyers as they struggled to don their hard suits. He never saw the dome punctured. The meteoroid that punched through both layers of the plastic was a nearly microscopic grain of dust, but Voznesensky heard a different sound, like a sudden gusting intake of breath, the kind of sound a man makes when he's been stabbed in the chest. He felt the breeze as the dome's air rushed toward the puncture. Books fluttered open in the wind. Loose papers flew across the dome like a covey of frightened birds. The hissing noise grew louder, a moan, a rushing torrent of air. Voznesensky whirled and saw dozens of the lightweight repair patches lifting off the floor to be sucked up against the wall of the dome. They flattened there, edges fluttering madly as the air rushed past them to escape the dome. The plastic walls began to sag between the dome's stiff supporting ribs. The surface of the wall was ripping faster than the patches could cover it. Ears popping, heart trip-hammering, Voznesensky rushed to the spot, bent down to scoop up more of the repair patches, and slammed them over the widening hole. They slipped down, would not stay. They still fluttered, and Voznesensky could hear the dome's air roaring now as it rushed into the near vacuum outside. In a few minutes, it would all be gone. The force of the escaping wind was tugging at him, trying to suck him through the wall and out into the deadly open. Without a word or a call to anyone, he braced himself and began to struggle back toward the center of the dome, leaning against the wind, staggering like a drunk, threading his way painfully past the scientists' workstations, dodging chairs in the wardroom carelessly left scattered about the floor. His ears were screaming with pain as if someone had jabbed ice picks into them. The life support equipment, pumps that sucked in the dry, cold air of Mars, separators that culled the scanty nitrogen and even scantier oxygen out of the native atmosphere, more pumps to make the nitrogen-oxygen mix thick enough for humans to breathe, cylinders of spare oxygen in case of emergency. He had to reach the oxygen. Voznesensky went down the row of green, man-tall oxygen tanks, twisting their valves to the full open position, over-pressurizing the dome as quickly as he could with pure oxygen. Force oxygen into the dome replaced the air being lost. It was a race, and he had no intention of losing. Higher pressure might even push the repair seals firmly against the hole. At the very least, it would buy them a few more minutes. Yet even over the hissing rush of the escaping oxygen, he could hear, puck. He clawed his way back toward the tear in the wall in a blizzard of papers swirling through the dome. By the time he got back to the place where the meteoroid had broken through, Abel was there in his white hard suit, spraying epoxy over the repair patches as calmly as a painter doing a living room wall.
"I have turned on the emergency oxygen," Voznesensky said, almost breathless, his chest aflame.
"Right,"
said Abel. It was standard emergency procedure. The wind had died down. The shriek of escaping air had quieted. Voznesensky was panting, but from fear and exertion, not lack of oxygen.
"Are the others in their suits?"
Abel turned toward him, a faceless robot in rust-stained white.
"Uh-huh. You should be too, Mike."
"Yes, yes."
Voznesensky saw that the patches were no longer fluttering. They were glued flat to the curving wall.
"What about the people outside?"
"They're coming through the airlock. Nobody's been hurt, far as I know."
"Good. Now, if we are not struck again..."
"You should get into your suit,"
Abel reminded him.
"Yes, of course."
By the time Voznesensky was fully suited up, though, he heard no more sounds of meteoroids striking the dome. He clumped awkwardly to the communications console and saw on the screen that Tolbukhin was still on duty up in orbit and still in his coveralls. His armpits were dark with sweat. Dr. Lee stretched his long legs as far as he could, considering the pain, and wriggled his bare toes until a cramp in his left calf began to